I am Jean Marie Subany. I am with Montana Conservation Voters Education Fund out of Livingston. And we are part of a coalition of groups that decided to do this event because of the anxiety and the outrage over the administration's in D.C.'s push that's anti-environmental, both in terms of the budget, but as well as some of the proposals for rule rollbacks that protect public health and clean air and clean water. Some of them are, for example, the EPA budget cuts of almost 31 or over 31% that, if ever went through, would affect a lot of the things that matter to us and our communities and our families, including things like Superfund, clean air, clean water, brownfields, all kinds of issues that we have benefited from over the last many decades. The other thing is the whole issue of science and this idea that we're just going to wipe the facts about science off the websites, off the agency websites that we all rely on for information, and not just us as individuals or organizations, but also states as well. We cannot let that science simply disappear. We have to have access to it to know what's happening in our world. We have something to say about those proposals, and we think you do too. So that's the reason for this event today. The process is going to be is we're going to start with a panel of community leaders. I'm going to introduce Carson and then turn it over to him. And each of those people will have 5 to 7 minutes to speak. Then we're going to turn it over to you. And any of you that have comments that you want to make, 2 to 3 minutes, please come up here, because we are videotaping this as well as recording it for your local radio station, community radio station. So we're asking people to come up here so we can tape it. Our idea is that we will then consolidate some of those comments, and we want to send them to our elected leaders and others so they can see what are people in Bozeman, Livingston, elsewhere saying about what is happening in Washington, D.C. So please come up here and do that, and Carson's going to run that show. I do want to mention the groups that are co-sponsoring this. There's 14 of them, so I don't want to forget them. Montana Conservation Voters Education Fund, NRDC, Moms Clean Air Force, National Wildlife Federation, Montana Wildlife Federation, Sierra Club, Environment Montana, Clean Air Montana, Montana Women for, Park County Environmental Council, Indivisible Upper Yellowstone, Yellowstone Bend Citizens Council, Montana Audubon, and Montana Environmental Information Center. So you can see the breadth of interest in pushing back on what's happening in Washington, D.C. that affects clean air, clean water, public health, and the things that we've benefited from in our communities. So with that, I'm going to introduce Carson. You know him probably better than I. I'm in Livingston. Many of you live here in Bozeman and have had the pleasure of Carson's leadership for a long time. He is just finishing his 2-year term as mayor of Bozeman, a remarkable conclusion to decades of public service, first as mayor, then as deputy, before that deputy mayor, before that city councilor, and before that even school board. When he first ran for mayor, he said one of his priorities was to work on more on climate change and having more aggressive implementation of the Community Climate Action Plan. His vision included addressing long-term sustainability by attracting good-paying industry, using our environment as a selling point. He was the first mayor in Montana to sign the mayor's agreement with other mayors from across the country pushing back on President Trump for his announcement to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. And he deserves a lot of credit for that. So without further ado, I want to introduce Carson, and thank you again for coming.
Thank you very much. We each have 5 to 7 minutes, so I'm going to get through this. Truth be told, I did not think that my signing of the mayor's climate protection agreement was anything all that significant. Meaning, it was a no-brainer for me, and it was a no-brainer for a variety of reasons. And I think I'm just going to explain why. because it gets to some of what we have to do as citizens of Bozeman, as citizens of Montana, I shouldn't use the word citizen, really, it's all of us residents, regardless of what our status is. First of all, cities are responsible for more than 70% of global energy-related carbon emissions. Cities are responsible. So maybe we don't need the United States of America if most of the cities in our country will act. And the last count I had, 1,060 U.S. communities have signed the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement. That's a pretty good number. I was first in Montana, big deal. Okay? Let's make that perfectly clear. The city of Bozeman since 2007 has been talking about carbon emissions, talking about greenhouse gas emissions, and how to cut them down both as a city and as a community. And we've taken action and created our own prior to the Paris Climate Accords. I keep calling it the Peace Accords, which is a Freudian slip on my part. It's probably part of what I really want. I like it, a worldwide peace accord. Wouldn't that be something? In any case, in 2008, Bozeman adopted a municipal goal of 15% below the 2000 levels by 2020, and a community goal of 10% below 2008 levels by 2025. We haven't done the assessment, which we will do this year, as to where we are on meeting those goals. I think we're much closer to them than we expected, and I expect that we will make those goals more rigorous in the coming year, hopefully before I leave office, but if not, shortly thereafter. I think that's a good thing that the city of Bozeman has done that. And I felt like, as the mayor, I could sign that protection agreement because it was totally consistent with what we were already doing as a city of Bozeman. But more important to me was, look, the world needs to act on this issue. And the idea that the President of the United States would do such a, and I'm going to call it selfish thing, such a thing that is his idea of what winning and losing is abhorrent to me. And I'm not going to stand here and say, okay, he pulled out, there's nothing I'm going to do about it. Nope, I'm going to say he hasn't changed one iota what the city of Bozeman is going to do, which is the only place that I can act. And so I signed it, and I willingly say, look at, climate change is not about winning and losing. Climate change is about all of us cooperating with one another to do what we can do, basically, to save the world. And I won't be around to see whether we actually saved the world or not. But the reality is my grandchildren will be. And I hope that my grandchildren are able to look other people in the face and say, my grandfather did what he could. So what is the city doing? We have cajoled, cooperated with Northwest Energy to have a community solar project out there on the frontage road. We provided the land for free, and you know what? The city should provide land it has for free for anything that's going to have an effect on the climate. They provided the solar panels. Montana State University is doing a study with it, and my hope is that this will lead to a great big community solar project that people in the community can invest in and make it a difference. Because ultimately, in the state of Montana, how energy is produced and distributed is going to be a really important thing in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. We also have worked with local businesses and people to encourage them to limit their emissions. So we have a project that involves money. Businesses come in and we look through what they're doing and give them ways to save on their energy bill and save on their energy consumption. And for the community, we have a competition. I'm not sure I like the idea that we need to compete around greenhouse gas emissions, but you know what? we need to do something. And if it will motivate people, it certainly motivates me. I hate to admit that about myself, but I look at my greenhouse gas emissions every month to see how I'm doing. And if you're looking at what you're doing, it's going to help you reduce them along the way. So we have done that. The big question for the city, ultimately, is do we do things that are more mandatory? Do we do things that are less voluntary? I don't have an answer to that at this point. But I do think we're at a stage where we all need to do everything that we can do. And that includes state government, county government, city government, and national government, as well as individuals along the way. So I'm now going to move to the experts. And the introductory notes that I have are over there on the table. So, Dan, if you could hand them to me. It seems so efficient to have them there. I guess just to conclude my little piece, the city is doing what it can and it will continue to do more around greenhouse gas emissions in the community, in the city. And we're also endeavoring to influence other entities like Northwestern Energy and like the county to do more as well. When we do building, we're looking at what our greenhouse gas emissions will be for that building. That will be true of police sheriff station, the law and justice center, anything that we do, we're going to do that. The school district is the same way at this point. They are looking carefully at what they're doing and what they're building, and I think that's a good thing for all of us in the community. So thank you to the school district for that, and thank you to for the city commission for doing what it's doing. Now I'm going to introduce people that actually know what they're talking about. Dan Vermillion was raised on the banks of the Yellowstone River and has spent much of his free time hunting and fishing. He's an attorney and owner of Sweetwater Travel with his brothers, and he owns and operates fishing camps throughout the world. He lives in Livingston. Dan has served on Montana's Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commission since 2007. Currently, he is its chair. As a commissioner, Dan has developed an in-depth knowledge of Montana's fish and wildlife resources and has spoken frequently about the threat of climate change on our world-renowned trout populations. In 2009, he had the distinct – I'm really jealous about this. This is, like, totally unfair. In 2009, he had the distinct pleasure of spending an afternoon fly fishing on the East Gallatin with President Barack Obama, a testament to Dan's skill and commitment. I give you Dan Vermillion.
Mayor Taylor indicated I'm Dan Vermillion. I, along with my two brothers, we own a company called Sweetwater Travel over in Livingston. We have, you know, we spend our time and make our living taking people and bringing tourists to Montana to hunt and fish, and not so much hunting, but fishing. And, you know, as we've all known, I'm sure all of us that have been here, whether you've been here 6 months or 45 years, you have seen something change in Montana. And from my perspective and from the fishing perspective and as a commissioner, you know, one of the things that the commission has to do every year is try to figure out when it is safe to fish for trout and when it's not. And so over time, we've had to develop a list of thresholds that would trigger our instituting hoot owl restrictions where you can't fish after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And since 2007, when I've been on the commission, I think we've had closures just about every single year. The earliest closure we've had was probably in 2008, which was late June. This year, a year that I think all of us, if you'd gone back 8 weeks ago, thought it was going to be a great year with water everywhere. You know, we've already closed every river or put restrictions on every single river in southwest Montana except the Yellowstone. So that means the Madison, the Gallatin, the Jefferson, the Big Hole, and the Beaverhead. So, you know, that's the backbone of a lot of the reasons so many of us live in Montana. It's the backbone for why so many people come to southwest Montana every year to fish. And from our business's perspective, you know, when we were kids or 15, 20 years ago, when we went and started to try to figure out how to schedule our season, we would schedule it and we would tell people, well, you can't fish the Yellowstone before the 10th of July. It just isn't, you know, very, you can't depend on it being clear by before the 10th of July. And even that sometimes was a little bit early. And, you know, if you really want some of the best fishing of the year, come in August. Well, over the last 10 years, we kept, and all the guides and outfitters have done the same thing. For a long time, we kept telling people, you know, this has to be a blip. August is going to be fine. But over, especially like after last year, I mean, our fisheries in August are really challenging. So this year, you know, all of our, 90% of our summer business is in June, July, and September. August is almost quiet. And you can talk to the fly shops in Livingston, and they're all telling you the same story. And that is that our clients, our guests, our tourists that come to Montana, they're adjusting how they plan their vacations. And one of the things I think all of us have probably seen is that rivers are busier and busier than they used to be. So if you combine lower than average flows and more people trying to fish in a tighter time frame, you really do affect the quality of the experience. And anybody that's fly fished recently in Southwest Montana has probably noticed that the river's a little busier than they have been in the past. And so, you know, I'm not really sure, you know, from my perspective as a fishing guide, as an outfitter, you know, that's a really troubling development. We are lucky in our companies that we have lodges in different parts of the world, but there is not a single, so we have lodges in Brazil, the Bahamas, Mongolia, Alaska, British Columbia, and there is not a single lodge that we own in a single place that we own where we haven't seen dramatic change in the last 10 to 15 years. And you can talk to a herder in Mongolia, you can talk to the farmers and ranchers in Montana, and you know, you will see almost universal acceptance and acknowledgement that something's going on. There is a change out there and people are concerned about it. There are those that say, well, heck, it may just be a blip. You know, there's people like Ryan Zinke who will tell you, or Secretary Zinke, I guess I should say, that will tell you, well, we know something's happening, but we don't know why. And so there's this sliding scale of the first step is climate denial or climate change denial. And then the next step is, well, we know something's happening, but we don't really know what, or we don't know why it's caused. And I predict, and unfortunately, I think the third step is going to be, well, it's happened. There's not much we can do about it now. So let's go ahead and just try to mitigate the impacts instead of changing how we behave, how we act, and try to stave off what we all know. At least, you know, in Trout and Loon, it's done its research in Montana, could be very dramatic, you know, really dramatically impact the long-term health of our fisheries. Now, you know, take fishing aside, take the trout aside. The other places you're seeing impacts is, you know, if you're a rancher in the middle of Yellowstone and you have, like, for example, our ranch, we have 1882 rights, we have 1878 rights and 1894 rights. We haven't been able to use our 1894 rights after July 15th in 20 years. So that means that in 1894, the river was already over-appropriated. But we could use, those rights were actually viable and capable of being used up until the last 10 or 15 years. So, you know, ranchers, I think slowly but surely in last summer, you know, when we had the fish kill on the Yellowstone, you know, there was a lot of outcry like, well, the agricultural community needs to change its behavior, change its uses. And there were folks in Paradise Valley in particular who had the oldest water rights in the valley, and they didn't have water to water their crops. So, you know, it's not really about, I mean, there are probably, and I'm sure there are places where the ag community could be a little bit, you know, there's certain places where they could be a little bit more efficient with their water use. But the bottom line is there's less water and there's more people and our needs are growing. If you look at a town like Bozeman, I'm not exactly sure where you get all your water, but I assume a lot of it is from the groundwater and also from a lot of your surface water. So from Highlight or wherever else. And so if you look down the road and if what we see happening now is happening in 20 or 30 years, but in an accelerated rate, you know, it raises real questions about where Montanans are just going to get the water to run their cities and their towns. And, you know, I think that it really, it's very disturbing to me. It's very disturbing to me and to the folks that in our industry because it does affect how we make our living. But it's even more concerning just from a human perspective that, you know, we all have children or have friends who have children and we look at those kids and, you know, we all want to see our children or other friends' children to have the same opportunities that we had to grow up in a Montana that was really unique, that brought all of us here, our parents here in the first place. So, you know, that's a really, and to see that slipping away and feel it slipping away is, it's kind of heartbreaking. And I think that it's, you know, it's really something that I think all of us know that something's going on. It's, I find it very discouraging when you look at our present leaders in Montana, you know, at the federal level, with the exception of Senator Tester, not really being willing to engage in discussing this issue or at least addressing it. And, you know, last year or 2 years ago, and Senator Phillips would know better than me, but Montana Farmers Union came out with some sort of a paper that actually, you know, they acknowledge climate change and they acknowledge that we need to do something about it. And that's a real step forward in the rural communities. I think everybody knows something's happening. You know, go to northeastern Montana this year. I mean, 6 weeks ago, they thought they were going to have, I should say 3 months ago, they thought they were going to have a pretty good year because they had great soil moisture because last fall was so wet. They had floods last fall in October. And now you look at the pictures in the paper and their wheat crops have just shriveled. And if you look at, you know, Montana, a lot of our wheat production is dryland wheat. So it relies on normal moisture and reasonable temperatures to allow that wheat to germinate and to create one of the great wheat crops growing areas in the United States. And so, you know, in years like this, it gets really hard because even on the best of years, their margin may be an inch or two of moisture. So when it dries up and it gets drier and hotter, that moisture doesn't go nearly as far. And they end up in a situation that, you know, is really untenable. And then you find, you know, the government has to step in and help these folks to stay on their places, stay on their ranches or their farms to continue to farm for another, you know, future generations. And, you know, I think that's really important. And I think most people think that's really important because one of the things we all love about Montana is its open space. And the agricultural community is a huge part of that open space. So I think, you know, I hope that we can have a partnership going forward. I think that there's a real possibility where towns like Bozeman, because so many folks that grew up and went to college in Bozeman now live, say they live in Circle. They have a special attachment to towns like Bozeman. And I think there's an opportunity there to create a dialogue so it's not like, well, that's what Bozeman or Missoula does. You know, we're all Montanans, whether we live in Bozeman or Circle. And this is an issue that's going to affect all of us. And it's being felt very dramatically in our business. But it's going to be felt in other businesses as well. So it's really, you know, I guess the last example I would give is I'm sure a lot of folks have heard about the Pebble Mine up in Alaska. So the Pebble Mine had been killed under, or at least somewhat delayed, significantly delayed under the Clean Water Act under President Obama. And the mining company from Canada, the first thing they did as soon as the permit or the 404C exemption of the Clean Water Act was exercised, they filed a suit. And the suit just sort of sat there. And then Administrator Pruitt comes in, and what is one of the first things he does is he settles the lawsuit to allow that permit process to restart, and they could build the largest open-pit gold mine in Alaska in the heart of 62% of the world's remaining wild salmon runs. I mean, why would you jeopardize that? It makes no sense to me. It makes no sense to the people that live there, but we're having a hard time getting our voices heard by those folks that make the decisions. And, you know, the reason all of you are here is because you're involved, you care. And I think our biggest challenge going forward is how we're going to get more people to feel the way we do, that we're willing to take our time on a Wednesday afternoon on a hot summer day in Bozeman to come to an event like this, to talk about this issue, and to figure out how we can get more people to join the opposition or the resistance to the fact that this administration just refuses to acknowledge us, and they can see it happening right out in their front yards, but they don't seem to want to do anything about it. And it's up to us, I think, to make sure that they do change. And, you know, maybe that's 2018. I hope it is. But at the very least, we need to keep this drumbeat alive. And, you know, thank you so much to Montana Conservation Voters and the other groups that are here today for keeping these sort of events going and keeping people talking about it, raising the awareness, because I've been working on this issue kind of, you know, softly for a lot of years, and I've really seen a change in Montana as far as the just the awareness. You know, one of the most compelling examples people have used around Livingston is that 20 years ago there were no smallmouth bass upstream of Lake Huntley. Now this year they found them an emigrant. So that's what, 17 miles from Yellowstone Park. And if you look at that fish kill that happened last year in Yellowstone, on the Yellowstone, that was directly attributed to low flows, warm temps. And that is when those bryozoa, that spore that caused so much damage to our fisheries, that's when they thrive. Well, this year, you know, the biologists thought, well, great, we're going to have a great scouring event. Everything, you know, we should really be able to bump all that back and kind of put it back on its heels. Well, let's hope it doesn't stay this hot and that in the middle of August we're not having the same conversation we had last year, because what the department is finding on the Yellowstone in particular is that fisheries like around Columbus, Park City, Laurel, Gray Cliff, Big Timber, that were traditionally trout fisheries, they've seen a steady decline over the last 30 years of trout populations. And, you know, that's directly attributable to the lack of water and the lack of habitat. Fish need cold water. They need clean water. Montana does pretty darn well on clean. We're struggling now with supply and cold. And I think that is one of our biggest challenges going forward. And I think it's something that, you cannot overstate its importance, and you can't overstate its importance to our economy. So I, thank you to everybody for coming today, and really hope that, these sort of events can continue to occur and that we can be successful next year and the years to come and making it, kind of turning this ship around and hopefully moving it in the right direction.
All right, so if you're sitting in a chair that has an empty chair next to it, would you raise your hand? All right, there must be people that are my age that can't stand to stand for too long. Someone come take those chairs right up there. Thank you. The next speaker is Andrea Peacock. She is a journalist who has covered Western politics and conservation news for well over two decades for publications including Mother Jones, High Country News, The Denver Westward, and Austin Chronicle. She writes frequently for counterpunch.org and is the former editor of the Missoula Independent. She was the recipient of a 2010 Alicia Patterson Foundation Fellowship for her work on the ways oil and gas development affect communities in the Rocky Mountain West. She's the author of Libby Montana, Asbestos and the Deadly Silence of an American Corporation, as well as the more recent Wasting Libby, the true story of how W.R. Grace Corporation left a Montana town to die and got away with it. Andrea Peacock.
I wanted to start with just a brief synopsis of what happened in Libby to give you all kind of a feel for the scope of the problem and the scale of the cleanup efforts there. For those of you who don't know, there was a vermiculite mine operating in Libby for almost 70 years. And as it turned out, the vermiculite was contaminated with asbestos. State inspectors knew this as early as the 1940s, but they weren't required by law to inform the miners, so the miners were not informed. But the mine's employees were showing evidence of disease by the 1950s. The W.R. Grace Corporation bought the mine in 1963, in part with the hopes of developing a commercial use for the asbestos that was in the vermiculite. So asbestos causes cancer, and it causes respiratory disease, and the cancer it causes and the diseases it causes are fatal. As one of the community activists in Libby likes to put it, Gayla Benefield, it's going to kill you unless you get smacked by a truck first, or a bus. She changed it up. So the asbestos industry knew by the 1950s that asbestos caused fatal diseases. When Grace bought the mine in 1963, then it knew that asbestos was deadly in general and was causing disease in the Libby workforce specifically. The corporation provided no informed consent, nothing in the way of effective protective gear. Miners went home dusty every night and exposed their families. The company was sloppy with its product, leaving it in piles all over town, even giving the leftover ore to the high school to pave its running track with. So when the story broke in 1999, the EPA had a huge mess to clean up. And I'd like to outline as best I can, briefly, how the cleanup progressed, just to give you an idea of the scale. First, Libby's asbestos fiber is unique. It's called tremolite or Libby amphibole, and it turned out to be far more virulent than commercial types of asbestos, so existing regulations and standards weren't adequately protective. Furthermore, Grace was not forthcoming with the data it had about the uniqueness of Libby's fiber, nor did it share the results of its medical studies, which tracked miners and their exposure over decades as they sickened and died. So the EPA emergency response team had to figure out from scratch exactly what they were dealing with, how dangerous it was, and come up with new sets of standards, even just to decide what sorts of microscopes to use and filtering processes. And then they had to craft an appropriately stringent set of standards for cleanup. The feds have to date linked 400 deaths to asbestos in current or former Libby residents. In 2001 and 2002, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry did a series of health screenings testing more than 7,000 people who had lived and worked in Libby prior to 1990, and approximately 18% of those people showed evidence of asbestos-related disease. They set that date, 1990, because it takes a decade minimum for asbestos-related diseases to show up. And in the case of mesothelioma, which is an extremely rare cancer that's caused by asbestos, it can take up to 40 years to show up after exposure. So with that in mind, it means that medical screening should continue for about four decades after the last date of exposure. And if you think there was a sufficient degree of awareness and caution by the early 2000s, so that people weren't being exposed after that point, more or less, it means we're looking at new diagnoses for at least another 20 years. So emergency response units, like the one the EPA sent to Libby, are designed for small-scale incidents, not for decades-long, multi-hundred-million-dollar cleanups. So the EPA's initial effort could not be sustained long-term. The Superfund was enacted for exactly the kind of situation Libby was in, and in 2002, that designation was made. This past January, the EPA issued a last call for signing up properties to be cleaned using Superfund money. So in the intervening 15 years, the EPA spent $600 million evaluating 7,500 homes and properties and performing asbestos abatements in about a third of those properties. What would things have been like for Libby without the Superfund cleanup? So Libby's vermiculite was used in an estimated 33 million buildings around the United States. That's the EPA's number. So we have some idea of what people deal with when they find themselves in that situation without the help of the EPA or the Superfund cleanup money. I've got a couple of friends who live here in Bozeman now, but when this was all in the news, they had just bought a house in Columbia Falls that turned out to have Libby vermiculite in the walls. My friend was a midwife, and she had planned to operate her practice out of her home. So right there, it affected her ability to earn a living. They couldn't, with a clear conscience, sell it without telling potential buyers. But if they told potential buyers, they couldn't sell it at all. I wrote a little bit about their situation back when it happened, and I thought I'd read a short excerpt from that story. The contractor told Katie and David the vermiculite in their attic was no big deal. They'd heard too many horror stories from Libby to feel secure. So they decided to investigate further. They brought in an assessor from across the state in Billings and looked up a man who had lived in the house as a child. Between the two, they surmised that the knee wall space along the base of their walls had once been full of vermiculite and that their pipes were wrapped in newspaper stuffed with vermiculite. From what they could figure, the previous owner had gone in with a shop vac and sucked out what he could, and the process probably contaminating the entire house. A sample of the vermiculite in the attic tested positive for asbestos at 0.5%, well within the EPA's safety standard of less than 1%. The problem, says EPA Dr. Aubrey Miller, a veteran of the Libby cleanup, is that 1% standard has proved to be meaningless when it comes to Libby amphibole. Our work in Libby has clearly demonstrated that materials that have less than 1%, well less than 1%, are dangerous. And when we went back and reviewed the basis of that rule, the 1% rule, it had absolutely no basis, essentially, with regard to the hazardous nature of materials. 1% means nothing about whether something's hazardous or not. If you have vermiculite attic insulation, it is a hazardous material, period. Don't touch it. Don't go near it, he says. If you've got it and you can get rid of it, then do so. So Katie and David consulted experts. They had their air tested and faced a tough decision. The average cost of a home cleanup in Libby in 2002 was $150,000, more than they had paid for their house to begin with. Should they spend tens of thousands of dollars they did not have to remove all traces of vermiculite from their home? Or have the walls sealed, the house cleaned with wet wipes, and hope for the best? They opted for the latter. They spent $6,825 and had finally stopped holding their breaths. Katie said, after it was totally cleaned, this fellow came in and we were out of the house. He used blowers and set up air quality monitors, and all those tests came back totally clear. So that made us feel better about being in the living space. But you know, you feel like on hot days you wish you had a fan in the attic, and you realize you can't because the attic is toxic. So the EPA money spent in Libby doesn't represent the actual toll in human suffering, but it stopped an otherwise endless cycle of exposure and disease. So Libby has a future because the EPA had the money to do the cleanup there. And without the Superfund, I'd say that Libby would be a ghost town today. So thank you.
Erica Lighthizer is the co-founder and community organizer for Montana Mountain Mamas, an organization of women throughout Montana that come together to enjoy and share the great outdoors, advocate and educate so kids and communities can continue to enjoy clean air, clean water, and the freedom to access Montana's lands and waters. She is a scientist who also serves as the program director for Park County Environmental Council in Livingston, an organization dedicated to protecting Park County's rivers, wildlife, and landscapes. Erica is an adventure cyclist, hiker, and skier who once spent a summer with her family, including husband, three children, and a dog, as cycling vagabonds in the Rocky Mountain West, traveling over 2,000 miles from Colorado to Montana. They were recently featured on the DIY Network. I have no idea what that is. For their building of an off-the-grid house over 6 months last year. Erica Lighthizer.
Thanks, everybody. So I work for three organizations that advocate on behalf of public health and the environment. But I'm not here today as an expert, Mayor Taylor. I'm actually here as a mom. So I'm deeply concerned about these EPA budget cuts and what they might do to impact Montana families. The EPA plays a critical role in protecting public health. Right now, there are families living all over state, some of which Andrea described, with pollution. Many Montanans live in Superfund communities. I live in Livingston, where we have a large diesel plume underneath most of our town, and from years and years of unregulated railroad activities. Montana has 17 Superfund sites, but I assure you there are other sites that are also contaminated that may not have achieved Superfund status, I guess, if you want to call it a status. Through my work, I get to meet with a lot of women throughout the state, and they share with me their concerns and what impacts them in their community. Recently, I had the opportunity to travel to Anaconda, where a small group of women came together and met with me and expressed some of the situation that they're experiencing right now. These moms are living with the reality that their children have unsafe levels of lead in their bloodstream. In some cases, like three times the level of CDC concern. Lead poisoning causes several symptoms. It causes things like stomach pain and behavioral problems, anemia. But probably worst of all is it can really impact a child's developing brain, right? So, I'm a little emotional about it. So children in Anaconda, they're not getting the lead from paint. It came from the smelting operations associated with the Anaconda smelter. And it's everywhere. It's in the soil. It's in the water. It's in the dust. It was in the children's playground sandbox at some of the highest concentrations. It's everywhere. Imagine getting your yard tested and realizing where your kid's swing set is. It has elevated levels of arsenic. Or maybe where you were going to put a garden, you have elevated levels of lead. As a mom, I would be concerned about my child running barefoot, about getting dirt in their mouths. Kids always eat dirt. And in a place like Anaconda, that's a huge fear. You have to take your shoes off every time you go in and out of a house in Anaconda because you know, you could track in some of that polluted soil into your home. The cleanup process in Anaconda is already going painfully slow. From what I heard, I heard stories where even sort of high-risk people, pregnant mothers, folks with young children, they had already had their yards tested for elevated lead and heavy metals, but the EPA had not remediated their home yet. So they were forced with a decision. They could wait it out, or they could remediate their yard themselves. So in one case, a family shovelful by shovelful for three summers remediated their own yard one shovelful at a time, essentially. You know, it's already going slowly, but I can't imagine what would happen if the EPA budget was cut even further, right? It would grind to a halt, right, in these communities. And Superfund communities, the pollution is localized, right? And if it's so difficult to clean up even those communities where the pollution is isolated and in a certain area, when I think about a problem like climate change or a much bigger problem that goes across borders, that goes, you know, that's not localized to a community, I can't imagine, you know, what a budget cut to addressing our climate problem would do long term. So, yeah, that's all I needed to share, I guess, today. And I'm very, very concerned, and I look forward to hearing all of your testimony and sharing with you and hearing from you. So.
So Erica reminded me of one caveat. I happen to be the mayor of Bozeman, but I really am speaking from my own experience in what I do. I don't speak for the commission except when we're meeting as a commission. So I just wanted to point that out. Our next speaker is Mike Phillips, Senator Mike Phillips, state senator only. I wish he were our real senator. I'm not going with who I think is the fake and who's the real. I'm just not going to go there. But I bet Mike Phillips isn't in favor of repealing, period. I'm off topic, as usual. Senator Mike Phillips has served in the Montana legislature since 2007, first in the House and now in the Senate. He is an outspoken leader on climate change and founded the Montana Legislative Climate Change Caucus. He has led the charge on expanding Montana's net metering laws, allowing homeowners and businesses to install clean, renewable energy generation, and he's played a critical role in crafting and passing the nation's most comprehensive law for sequestering CO2 in geological formations. In the fall of 2009, Mike was recruited by the White House to join a coalition of state legislative leaders to work with the Obama administration and the U.S. Senate in an effort to pass clean energy, jobs, and climate change legislation. Mike's career focuses on imperiled species recovery, and he has played a key role in the wolf conservation and recovery. He has served as the director of the Turner Endangered Species Fund and an advisor to Turner Biodiversity Division since 1997. Prior to that, he served in the National Park Service as project leader for the wolf restoration effort. Mike Phillips.
I didn't know I was a fake senator, but that's better than not being a senator at all. So thank you, Mayor Taylor. There's another fake senator, one of the hardest working legislators that I know of, in the form of Jennifer Pomnikowski, the AJP. I mentioned that because ultimately we can sit here today and we can hear stories about this problem and that problem, but we need to take this newfound knowledge and turn it into action. I stand ready. JP stands ready. There's lots of folks in this room that can help move us forward. And so I'm going to try to speak to things that we can do. But first, you need to note some numbers. You need to note 407. 407, probably 407 point something, right now was the atmospheric concentration of CO2. Now, you might think 407 is a big number. It certainly is, but it increases by about 3 parts per million per year. So in about 15 years, it'll be sitting at about 450 parts per million. The best science makes clear. At 450 parts per million, all bets are off in terms of what that type of atmosphere will mean for weather patterns that over a decade or longer become the climate. We don't have a great deal of time. Be mindful the system is defined by latent periods so that what we do on Monday will have lingering effect for many, many Mondays to come. 407 is a big number to remember. Also, remember about 20 names. So the United States withdraws from the Paris Agreement, but these countries don't. Albania, Angola, Armenia, Bahrain, Belarus, Benin, Bhutan, Burundi, Chad, East Timor, Gabon, Guyana, Haiti. I could go on and on. These are countries that are impoverished by any standards that matter, and yet they're still in the fight. Their leaders recognize that atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases matter. United States apparently doesn't agree with that. Gene spoke about science. Y'all know what science is? I've thought about this a lot as a conservation scientist working in the field of restoration ecology for almost 40 years now. Science is just the systematic accumulation of reliable knowledge. That's all it is. It's not perfect. It's just probably the best system we have for pursuing the best estimation of the truth. Our federal government, apparently President Trump, and far too many members of the United States Congress feel that the systematic accumulation of reliable knowledge is not an appropriate way to go forward as a collective. And yet they haven't identified any alternative. Action without information is nonsense. Action with information is just common sense. And so I would have you believe that President Trump continues to act in a nonsensical fashion by setting aside science as an important feature in our country's government by doing things like reducing EPA's budget. At the state level, we're working hard to try to move the needle. We brought in 2017 a simple bill. JP and me and others brought a simple bill. Senate Bill 190. Senate Bill 190 simply said the state of Montana should move in the presence of information in the right direction by recording greenhouse gas emissions. Just a registry, if you will. And that we should also develop a plan for reducing emissions, but the bill didn't require that the plan be implemented. That's all it aimed to do. Improve our understanding of our emissions. We actually did get Senate Bill 190 out of the Senate Natural Resources Committee. So for the second time in 10 years, just the second time in 10 years, we had on a chamber floor a full-blown discussion about climate change. After the discussion, which lasted about 10 minutes, the bill died on a party-line vote, 18-32. All of the Democrats voting in favor of this simple registry bill, all Republicans voting in opposition. But we haven't given up. We haven't given up. Both JP and I serve on Montana's Environmental Quality Council that will meet during the 2017-2018 interim. And EQC will begin to look at some related issues that are pertinent to climate change. We need your help. You need to make sure that the chairman of EQC knows that those activities during the interim are appropriate. Both JP and I would be more than willing to help everybody in the room know how to contact Senator Chaz Vincent, the chairman of EQC, and every other member of that interim committee. But we didn't stop there. Dick Barrett and I and a number of other legislators, senators and House members, and leaders from across the state, including Mayor Taylor, we wrote a letter to Governor Bullock. We said, you know, Governor, you shouldn't follow President Trump's lead. Montana should stand solidly behind the Paris Agreement. We sent him that letter. We haven't heard back, as best I can tell. Now, Senator Barrett and I intend to turn that letter into an op-ed that will appear in the major papers statewide. But here's where you guys come in. We should insist that Governor Bullock, under the authority of his office, sign an executive order that makes clear that Montana will go forward to do more than our fair share to secure a future for our children and grandchildren by beginning to manage greenhouse gas emissions. in the variety of ways available to us, we're going to manage greenhouse gas emissions to begin building an energy future that makes sense. You guys can help. The governor should hear that that type of executive order is strongly indicated. He's got a great example. I have it here right in my hand. This is the executive order from Governor Hickenlooper. Colorado stepped in the right direction. Montana should as well. That's a specific thing that you guys starting this evening could help us with. Anybody here that would be interested in helping us move the governor in the direction of an executive order, please let me or JP know or Mayor Taylor, and we will make sure that you're part of the movement to say to Steve, this is how Montana needs to go forward. This issue won't go away by sitting in a library room and listening to stories and then going home. All of us have to do more than our fair share to insist that elected leaders engage on this issue. In that regard, I implore you to insist that John Tester act on the issue during his reelection bid. And he would act by telling us exactly what we know we need to hear from our senior U.S. senator, and that is the problem is real, solutions are at hand, and they need to be embraced. When I was invited by the White House to help move energy legislation to the United States Senate, Senator Tester made clear he was on the right side of this issue. Every time I saw him in D.C., he said all the right things. I think John, more than most Montanans, gets this. He's a leader and knows that his actions matter. And his day job, he's an organic farmer outside Big Sandy, Montana. He understands what this means to Montana as much as anybody in the state. We need to give him the opportunity to use his voice during his 2018 reelection bid to tell stories that matter that will help move this state forward. So thank you for coming. I don't know where we are on time, but that's all I had for today.
Okay. This is being recorded. It will be used in whatever way Montana Conservation Voters and the other sponsoring organizations can to further the cause of fighting against the EPA cuts and fighting to minimize, get rid of our greenhouse gas emissions across the state and wherever we can. So one thing you can do right now is stand up here and give your point of view for the video and for local radio, because local community radio is going to broadcast this as well by using this microphone. So here we are. Who wants to step up first? 2 to 3 minutes. Come right up. If you want to create a line over here, that would be good.
Hey, everybody. My name's Kristen Walzer. I'm with Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm the state coordinator, and we work on a federal level. Who holds the purse strings for EPA? The House and the Senate on a federal level, 535 people. And so that's why we work on a federal level. And I want to tell people about a method, a way of going forward and influencing those people. We have people in chapters in every state and every single district. And what an amazing thing just happened last week. And I know it's a tiny step, but there was something called the Perry Amendment. And it was to block funding for the Department of Defense to study the impacts of climate change on national security, to block the Pentagon and the military from looking at how climate change affects their operations. And that was blocked. That was blocked by a vote of 185 to 235. What does that mean? Well, the reason why that happened was, I gotta give Citizens Climate Lobby a little bit of credit here. They helped start the Climate Solutions Caucus in the House. It has now 48 members. 24 of them are Republicans. When you have a Republican bloc voting, 22 of them voted against that amendment and to allow the DOD to study climate change. And they know, you know, the Navy's totally worried about all their bases that are at sea level when sea level rises. All of those bases, the billions of dollars that have gone into that, are washed away, literally. So right now, what you could do would be to help our representative voted against that, or voted for taking away that money. And so, as a group, we are working in Montana to work with, in a very respectful manner, with our representatives to change that. And if you're interested in helping us out and having your voice heard, that would be great. But this is kind of a methodology, a way to work, even in the face of a Republican Congress and presidency. There is a way to, on a kind of microclimate way, to really affect. And what I like to look at it is finding the cracks in the wall, and you just kind of dig away at those cracks and the humanity that is in every one of us, even in all the legislators in the Congress.
I am just an artist and an environmental activist. I have no job. I'm basically unemployable. I have no day job except painting and dreaming and writing. And what I'm really confused about is that anybody needs convincing as to climate change. About 35 years ago, I woke up in my early 30s to a talk that Tom Hayden gave in Santa Monica. And I started working for him for his campaigns when he was married to Jane Fonda. And honestly, they sent us to Columbia Pictures to meet with climate activists. And they said then, in the early 80s, that we had, you know, whatever science read out then, it was like so few years left before exponentially it would be gone. And it's because the human species was breeding exponentially, and here we are, guys. So I don't know what to say. I'm just pissed that the guys running the show haven't done anything about it until now. I don't understand it. Just please, Mike or Andrea, somebody plug me into some place. I can at least find hope, help in fundraising, donating something, imagery. I just dream and paint and write about animal existence on Earth. And frankly, I'm more nervous about all of the other critters that I care so deeply about. And human species is like, it's poisoning the planet at the rate we're exponentially overcoming the physical reality of nature. I'm terrified.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Rita Rozier. In the Livingston July 2nd parade, there was a Republican float that said on it, Montana is a Republican state. And election-wise, that's true. But I think that it's not the mandate that Senator Daines and Representative Gianforte may think that it is. A 2014 survey of Montanans showed that 86% of us consider, and this is a quote, issues involving clean air, clean water, open spaces, and public lands, end quote, are either somewhat or very important factors, even to the point that they consider these in political political matters and in voting. This 86% figure is borne out by Montana's involvement in organizations that work to protect our environment. And many of those are represented here, but many of them are not. I have a list of 30, and it's just a very partial list, but I'm only going to read a couple of them here. The Citizens Climate Lobby that Kristen mentioned has approximately 3,000 to 4,000 members. Montana's Trout Unlimited, 3,900 members. Moms Clean Air Force, 3,000 members. The MEIC,
5,000 members. Northern Plains Resource Council, 4,500 members. Arrow, between 1,000 and 2,000 members. They weren't sure. Montana Women 4 is growing by leaps and bounds. And there's, you know, there's smaller organizations like the Yaak Valley Forest Council near Troy that has close to 2,000 members, I just heard today. Now, there are many, many others, and most of the people who are in one or two of these groups are not in other groups. If we could add together all of our impact and all of our concerns about the environment, because even like Trout Unlimited, which I used to think 20 years ago was like, you know, wealthy Republicans. Sorry, that's just me. But but they have acted. They have done action on climate change. They have sent letters. They have worked hard to protect the quality and the temperatures of the stream. So it's fair to say that nearly all of the people involved in these would probably support the work of the EPA, the regulations, the leadership, and the enforcement that they are able to provide that the rest of us cannot do. And I think that we need to remember that climate change and environment are not a partisan issues, and that we need to remind our leaders, our political leaders, that these are not partisan issues, and we want all of them, even, you know, politically, it's a correct thing for them to do to get votes, to support us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Heidi Arneson. I'm a scientist, a mom, a school board member, and a candidate for city commission. I'm really proud to be part of a city, a school district, a business community that does care for our environment. We just had a four-hour discussion at the latest school board meeting, not on should we be green, but how should we be green and how should we document that. And I think those kind of discussions are very important. Because of natural beauty that surrounds us, we want to keep it that way. We want to keep our air clean, our water clean. We want to keep our trees green, and those things are very important to us. We need to protect our way of life here for our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren. I really want to thank Senator Phillips and the others of you that are giving us actions we can take, and for all of you for being here today, thank you for all that you do.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Christy Cooper. I'm a scientist and a documentary filmmaker. I'm working together with a group of 21 kids from across the country that maybe you've heard about. They're suing the U.S. federal government for creating this climate catastrophe that they're facing for their future. Their claim is that the U.S. government has known for six decades what increased carbon levels are going to do, and that they have willfully engaged in continuing to create this catastrophe. As Senator Phillips said, we're at 407 right now, parts per million of CO2. When my daughter was born, we were at 370. In her lifetime, she's going to see 450. And I know that the numbers sometimes are really hard to understand, but at 450, our oceans are going to be dead. There are going to be no more coral reefs alive. That's like a heartbreaking number for me to think about that my daughter is going to grow up with. I also wanted to say, Mayor Carson, I really appreciate your commitment to our community living up to the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement, however, is not enough. We can't go to 2 degrees Celsius. We're already at 1 degree Celsius, and we're seeing catastrophic impacts around the world. 2 degrees should not be our goal. We need to get carbon emissions under control. We need to reduce. We need to get back down to 350. So I ask you today to please support our country's youth. The vast majority of them can't vote. They don't have that voice, but we can give them platforms where their voice can be heard, because this is about their future. I see a lot of, I'll include myself in that mix, older people here in the group today. We need to create an environment where the young people and their voices are heard and that their concerns are met. And I just would really like to encourage you to do that. If you look up youthvgov, hashtag youthvgov, you can follow this this landmark climate change lawsuit. It's going to trial in February of this coming year in the 9th District, and I hope that you'll follow it and support it. This could be our one chance to let our executive branch have some power in this decision, and how our country is moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for including me in your age group. I really appreciate that.
My name is Jennifer Swearengin, and I'd like to thank the groups that made this happen today and all the participants here today. Yesterday, it was announced by NOAA that 2017 is on track to be the second warmest year on record. But in the future, we may not even have access to this kind of critically important information. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, housed in the Commerce Department, is facing very steep budget cuts. According to the Washington Post, the largest single cut is to the vitally important National Environmental Satellite Data and Information Service, which includes a key repository for all of the climate data. Last year, scientists at the Centers for Environmental Information reviewed that data and found, contrary to the claims of climate skeptics, that there had been no slowdown in the rate of climate change. And now that essential program is being axed. Why are they doing this? Well, I think aside from retribution, this is one of the biggest ploys in the polluter's handbook. If you stop the monitoring, then there's no data. And if there's no data, there's no problem. And it's clear that the Trump administration feels that there's no problem with climate change. On top of that, virtually all of EPA's climate programs are slated for elimination, including climate research, climate monitoring, and energy efficiency programs. They've already removed almost all of the climate-related information from their website, so that when you go to the EPA webpage and you click on climate change, you get the message that says, "We are currently updating our website to reflect EPA's priorities under the leadership of President Trump and Administrator Pruitt." I just find all of this appalling and so irresponsible. As we continue to shatter temperature records and experience more and more extreme weather events, our government is demolishing all efforts to mitigate climate change. This administration is moving us dramatically backward when scientists are warning us that we've got to take immediate action to limit carbon emissions if we're going to have a livable planet for our children. It is reckless and it is irresponsible. We have got to stand up, like Mike said, against this war on science. I strongly urge our congressional representatives to protect the health and safety of Montanans and block any effort to eliminate or defund these essential programs. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Will Swearengin, a citizen of Bozeman. As we know, the Trump administration is proposing many devastating cuts. I'm going to focus on just one program that is scheduled for elimination. This may seem like a small program, but it's had a huge impact. This is the Energy Star program. I think you all know if you go to buy an appliance, you may see a little sticker that says Energy Star, and then there's information about the energy efficiency of that. Well, this program was started by the EPA in 1992, primarily as a way to save energy then. But today, it really addresses both energy efficiency and climate change, basically just by educating consumers. You know that you probably know this is a voluntary program. Manufacturers of electronic devices can choose to have their devices or washing machines or TVs or air conditioners evaluated for energy efficiency. And the top 25% of the products are given this Energy Star certification. So over 25 years, what has this program accomplished? Well, 1,600 manufacturers have voluntarily signed up for it. More than 5 billion Energy Star certified products have been sold. Because of this program primarily, refrigerators today use 75% less electricity than they used to. The program conserves more than 350 billion kilowatt hours of electricity a year. It saved U.S. consumers a cumulative total of around $450 billion, which is over $30 billion a year. For the average household, that works out to about $500. So every one of your households is probably saving $500 a year because of this program. And it's prevented over 2.7 billion tons of greenhouse gases. So it's popular with consumers, it's popular with manufacturers, so why is this scheduled for elimination? The only reason I can come up with is that apparently the fossil fuel industry and the electric industry would like us to use more electricity. Well, the program has had bipartisan support up to this point. Its annual cost is only $50 million, which is not even decimal dust in the federal budget. So this is a program that really needs to be preserved for the benefit of U.S. consumers, but also for the health of the planet. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Allison Yund. I'm a private citizen and a civil engineering student here at MSU. And we're talking a lot about data and numbers today, and I think we all know that, you know, as much as we know that they are important, the administration kind of sees them as bunk. So I'm going to tell you a story, and I'm going to tell you a family story. My grandmother grew up in Great Falls, Montana, and was at the time considered the greatest tackle on the west side. Very active, very vibrant lady. She moved to Eastern Washington in the Tri-Cities area when she was a young girl. This was at the time that World War II was happening. If you're familiar with that area, the Hanford site, a Superfund site, and thank you for mentioning, I forgot who mentioned how many Superfund sites there are in Montana, but it is currently classified as a Superfund site, was enriching plutonium for one of the bombs that we dropped on Nagasaki, or I can't remember if it was Nagasaki or Hiroshima, it doesn't really matter. The important thing is that at the time they didn't realize the human health effects of plutonium, and they let the Columbia River run right through the facility in order to cool the nuclear fuel rods. She lived on an island, Blaylock Island, about half a mile downstream while this was happening. It was swimming in the water and eating the fish. After that, she was incredibly sick for the rest of her life and had a miscarriage and over 40 surgeries, very little intestines by the time she died. My mom was born without hip sockets and has had over 30 surgeries, mostly orthopedic, thyroid cancer, which is very common for second-generation babies of people exposed to plutonium. I have an autoimmune disorder, scoliosis, and a chronic pain issue. The environment, or our bodies reflect what happens to the environment. Healthcare, you know, this ties in very strongly with healthcare, which is another civil rights issue that is being discussed at that time and a social justice issue. If we care at all about people, the health expenses associated with these medical problems I have seen my family deal with is the number one reason people go into debt. Pollution causes asthma. You know, I go back home to California where I grew up, and I don't have to, you know, I have to use inhalers. I have to use a controller and a rescue inhaler. Here, I don't. I have worked for the Forest Service. I've done 3 seasons on cruise. One of them was fire. After that, of course, my immune system started eating me up. But the point is, we have people who want to work, who have the great work ethic, who have extremely strong values. And when we pollute their lands, when we restrict their ability to hunt and fish and enjoy our natural inheritance, we do a disservice. If you are politicians, you do a disservice to your constituents to ignore the needs of the people who hire you, who put you in your job. And so the EPA is the organization that serves this country in a huge capacity, and anything that is detrimental to its aims is detrimental to the people, the public employees, and the current administration represents. So do right by Americans and do right by the land.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm Linda Knoyer. I'm from Livingston. Well, I live in Livingston now. And I'm old enough to remember before there was an EPA. And I grew up in the Midwest, and I remember the Cuyahoga River catching on fire. I remember Lake Erie going bloop, 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 you know, instead of splash, splash, like it's supposed to. And I remember Lake Michigan being lined with dead fish. That was all before the EPA, and the thing that made the difference was the enforcement of sometimes of laws that were already on the books. And climate change is the elephant in the room. But there is so much more that the EPA does. And the very people who are opposed to the regulation of business and how the EPA may be hurting our economy are just taking for granted that we have clean air and clean water. Last summer, we had a family reunion from my husband's family, and there were 17 people who came. 12 of them, most of my husband's family, live in Cairo, Egypt. And they came, the first thing they said was, "Oh my God, it is so nice to be able to breathe the air." They don't have an EPA. And that was what everyone said is, you are so lucky to have these regulations that actually make it possible. I said, well, you know, this is Montana, it's rural and blah, blah, blah. They said, no, we landed in New York. New York's air was clean compared to Cairo, Egypt. And it's because you have regulations and regulators and make sure that your air and your water are clean. Bringing it back to Montana, you know, we do have lots of open spaces and we do have a rural economy, but we have the fossil fuel industry writ large. And I think John Tester is a great guy. I think Steve Bullock is a great guy. And I even think probably the Republicans that represent us are great people. But they all are 100% in support of the prosperity based on fossil fuel extraction in this state. And if we're going to keep Montana from becoming like the Midwest that I knew when I was growing up, we really need not only for the EPA to be able to continue to enforce those rules, but we need to stop selling this incredible state to the fossil fuel industries and start developing. I mean, just recently I heard a story about Rick Perry of Texas pushing wind energy in Texas because those Texan farmers could make money every time the wind blew. And that brought prosperity and huge numbers of jobs to Texas, where they've been in the thrall to the oil gods longer than we have. And there's no reason why our politicians can't do that same kind of thing here. So climate change is huge, air quality is huge, water quality is huge, and we take those things for granted. And it's easy to oppose the EPA's regulations on a strictly abstract basis, saying, oh, you know, I'm a libertarian and I'm all for companies being able to do whatever they want and that'll bring prosperity and blah, blah, blah. But here in Montana, we have to look at what things were once. I think those people who think, sorry, I just skipped a thought there. I think those people who are so opposed in the abstract are taking for granted, are forgetting what it was the EPA was brought here to save us from. And, you know, when you talk about the people of Libya and the people of Butte and Anaconda, those people know that the companies, given free rein, will just destroy our communities, our water and our air, poison our children, and then leave. And that's, you know, we're seeing that in the Bakken with the companies just pulling out when they're, when the economy doesn't support them anymore and leaving the communities to deal with the aftermath. So I'm just saying that the EPA, people need to really understand what it is we're risking to roll back the EPA.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jason Matthews, and I basically have three jobs here in Montana. I'm a partner in a rafting company on the Yellowstone. I own a dog sled tour company in Big Sky. I guess my third job is not in Montana. It's in Alaska. I have been on a five-year polar bear project in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And all three of the things that I have passion for in my work are just being devastated by climate change. And we can stand here and beg the government and politicians to help us, and it's probably not going to make a difference. So I just want to remind everyone, look at your own carbon footprint and invest in carbon offsets. Put money in carbon offsets. Don't rely on anyone else.